You want to just go ahead and say your name?
Joanne Kubicki.
Kelsey, do you have any blank corrections?
Yeah.
Kelsey, was the sound okay with that?
Okay.
Good? Yep. All right. Go ahead and if you would, just state your name and today's date to start off with.
Okay, Joanne Kubicki. Today is August 2nd, 2012.
And would you like to kind of say your association with the Metro Parks?
Okay, I'm the information specialist at Canal Visitor Center. I've been with the park for 21 years, starting out with the IGO program, Institute of the Great Outdoors, it's called, which is a backpacking canoeing class program. And now I'm, as an information specialist, I'm mostly jack of all trades, anything, purchaser, answer the phone, receptionist, talk to the visitors, lead programs. And that's it.
Cool.
Okay.
So let's go ahead. We're going to start with Ohio and Erie Canal, if that's okay, and we'll go through those questions and then
okay.
We'll go through the Washington Reservation.
Okay.
But kind of starting off with the park now, what kind of are some highlights or interesting points that you would suggest people kind of explore and check out, or maybe points that they'll definitely see right away?
Okay, mainly most people come to the Canal Visitor Center. A Canal Way Visitor Center. So we have our large building here that's supposed to replicate the outside of a factory because the area is so entwined with all the factories in the industry in the area. Inside the building are a lot of live animals, turtles, snakes, frogs. We are in the process right now of putting in new exhibits. But we also have meeting rooms, and we also here in the center do programs for the general public. So mainly the visitor center is the main starting off point. It's the gateway to the northern part of the National Heritage Towpath Trail. If you go down the hill is the actual canal, the original canal that was built, started in 1825. Finished in 1832. Down there now we stock the canal with fish, so we get a lot of fishermen coming down to fish. Plus, it's a great birding area, so down in that section you can walk the trail, actually on the original towpath that the mules would walk carrying the or pulling the canal boats. If you go further north, all the way to the end of our trail is the Harvard Gateway, and that's the northern section of our park. And there's a few parking centers up there, parking spots. If you go south, you'll see a lot of exhibits. Alcoa is right above the parking lot. Alcoa is a company, of course, Aluminum Company of America. They have a big display down on along the trail, talking about their company. There's a number of businesses donated land to create the park. Alcoa is one of them. There's an overlook, it's called Furnace Overlook, if you continue south, and it overlooks the river and talks about how the river shaped the valley. Again, a lot of nature items you can see. Farther south from there, again, you pass the fishing area and going south, you cross under the large trestle that the, can't think of the name of the train that goes over, the company that owns it right now, but there's a large trestle been there since the early 1900s. So you continue along the trail, which is paved, you continue all the way down past there to the Aqueduct Gateway, which is a, it allows the canal to go over the Mill Creek without disturbing Mill Creek water going under. So the canal, the aqueduct was built to allow the canal to float over the river without stopping and getting the canal boat out of the, off the canal and continue on its way. Now we have two large pedestrian bridges, and I don't remember when they were built, 2006 maybe, somewhere like that. They allowed the pedestrians and bikers to cross over Granger and Warner roads safely, because those roads are very highly used by trucks and cars. So further down is the West Canal Gateway. West Canal Gateway is under the Interstate 480 bridge, which was one of the longest bridges in Ohio. Across the street from there used to be a brick making industry, which was very big in this area in the early 1900s, 1800s and 1900s. There's not much down there now as far as brick making, but they still use the shale that that's in the sides of the walls across from the towpath. Mm-hmm. On the bridge is we have peregrine falcons that nest. They've been nesting there for years now, raising young. So they use the tall pillars of the bridge to have their nests, put their nests under there and raise young. It replicates where they're in their natural habitats of large cliff sides. So they've managed to use our structures, human structures, for their use. And then Lock 39 Gateway, as you're walking down, continuing south along the trail, if you look across the river, across the canal, you'll see Foote Family Farm, and that family farm's been there since the early 1800s. Their ancestors were one of the people that came here with Moses Cleveland, who was the person that Cleveland is named after. They did survey work here. Before they settled in the area. So you continue past there and you go to Lock 39 Gateway, which is at Rockside Road. And that gateway is a shared gateway with the Cuyahoga Valley National Park. It's Lock 39 is named after the lock that is not too far down from the parking lot. So if you go south on the trail, you go into the national park, and then you'll see the Lock 39. If you go north on the trail, you enter Ohio and Erie Canal Reservation, which is part of Cleveland Metro Parks.
I have a question. Is mm-hmm. there a reason why they're all called gateways? I don't know if there's a reason, or is it just the name?
It's the Ohio and Erie Canal National Heritage Corridor. Consists of, it runs for about 110 miles. And the plan is to recreate the trail all the way from Cleveland to Zohar, New Philadelphia area. Most of it's finished. A lot of it in Cleveland is not yet, but they're working on that. And they called them gateways, so they're gateways to get onto the towpath trail that runs through the National Heritage Corridor. Okay. So they're just calling them gateways into the parks into the park.
Like an entrance, kind of?
Right, right.
We are going to skip the B questions. We'll come back to that.
Okay.
And talk about Washington.
Okay.
But, so, can you talk about, you did mention a little bit at the certain, you know, the highlights, but can you talk about kind of which habitats you'll see in certain areas, or if it's one combined habitat? Like, will you see different types of animals in the northern part of the park versus southern part of the park?
Not so much. I think you'll see mostly everything within the whole park system, the whole park. The southern part of the park is very narrow, and on both sides of the park, the towpath and the all-purpose trail and the canal, is a lot of industry. So you have office buildings, you have the restaurants and the show on one side. You'll have more industrial facilities on the west side. So that one whole stretch all the way to about Warner Road is pretty much industry. So mainly what you will see there would be woodchucks and birds, rabbits. Smaller animals. You normally wouldn't see any larger animals. Once you get into the interior of the park, again, north of Warner, it becomes more parkish, more trees, more forest, hardly any industry. The industry, if it's there, it's pretty much off on the hillside higher up. We're in a little valley here. The main part of the park is down in a valley. And in that area, you'll see the habitat changes somewhat. The canal is always there, so you always have birds and fish, turtles, snakes along the canal. But once you get into the deeper part of the park, the birds change. You'll get wild turkeys. You'll get hawks. You get a lot of migrating birds, warblers. We do a lot of bird walks here. You'll have a lot of more nesting birds. We have coyotes, a lot of deer that you wouldn't see. So, and we have a wetland more than just the canal, which is a wide open water, which a lot of people fish in, so it's disturbed a lot. We have what in our blue heron wetlands is more of not a marsh, but more of a somewhat like a marsh. So it's less disturbed, quieter. We get great green herons that nest there. We get a lot of migrating through water birds, blue-winged teals that you normally wouldn't see other places. Wood ducks do nest in the area too. So that's more secluded. That's a different type of environment, habitat. You're by the river in the part of it, so we get a lot of flooding from the river, so that changes the habitat a little bit too, on and off, but we do a lot of birding, I said, down there. So it's a different type of habitat. It's more wooded, and the river being wider, and good fishing for the great blue heron and such. Bald eagles fly over a lot. We don't know of any nesting of the bald eagles in the area, but we see them a lot. So.
And can you maybe describe the physical look of some of the birds that you definitely think visitors will see if they're looking?
Okay, the first one that stands out would be the great blue heron, because it's so tall. It stands about 3 feet probably, and it's a very big bird, long legs, long bill, and it's grayish color, grayish blue, and it stands very still to hunt. It hunts in the water, it stands in the water and hunts, and it looks for fish and tadpoles and frogs. So it's very stealthy. stands there and waits and very slowly walks until it finds something fish it'll eat too. So that's one of the big things that a lot of people see and they get all excited about. Of course, we always have our resident geese. In the spring, it's fun. You see all the little babies going through their stages of development. But then people complain because they go to the bathroom all over the trail. So, but that's another big thing that people look at. They enjoy looking at are the geese. To bird, you'll need binoculars mainly to see any of the migrating warblers, or beautiful warblers coming through. We do have yellow warblers that nest here all the time. So they're small, but they're bright yellow. People get them mixed with the goldfinch, which is a different color, yellow, and has black on its wings, so they're a little different. The mockingbird is another bird that we see here that when we first opened 13 years ago, a mockingbird was throughout the area, was not known to be in the area nesting. So our center was very well known for people that like the bird would come here just to see the mockingbirds because they don't normally see them because they're normally a southern bird. And they're really pretty. They, by their name, they mock, which means they mock other birds, meaning they use the calls of other birds. So you could actually sit and listen to them as they're singing. You can name a cardinal, a robin, a blue jay. That's the bird is constantly mimicking them. They are beautiful birds. They're gray, robin size. When they fly, they have white patches on their wings and on their tail, so they're really noticeable.
And can you describe, just for the general public on the recording, kind of this bird migrating process? And can you kind of explain kind of how or why or when the birds kind of stop by, all these southern birds?
The biggest migration is in the spring. Most of the birds will come from Central and South America, where they spend the winter. They migrate. We're not quite sure why. At least I'm not quite sure why. I'm sure other people are. But they've been doing it for years, migrate from their wintering homes. They migrate north to, some will stay here in northern Ohio. Others will continue, most will continue into Canada and nest up in Canada. They nest, raise their young. As soon as they're done, they'll start coming back and heading back down towards their winter homes in North and South America and Central America. The area here is important for them because it's a flyway, more or less, part of the flyway, but it's also with the river and all the wooded areas and the shelter. They would have shelter, food, and water as they're making their way north. It's a long, long way. They have areas where they'll stop, rest, eat, and then continue north. In the spring, they more or less funnel into one air, the furthest northern point in Ohio, which is at McGee Marsh and Crane Creek. That point sits out into Lake Erie, and right across from there is Point Pelee. So it's almost like the shortest distance across Lake Erie because these birds have to migrate. They have to go over Lake Erie, fly over Lake Erie in one straight shot to get to Canada. So up in that area is where they stay, rest up again, eat, waiting for the southern wind to come up to assist them across the lake. Again, our area is just another stopping off point where they can rest, find food, and continue on their way. So in spring is the big migration. A lot of people come, and a lot of people come here to bird watch, or we do lead the hikes here for bird watching, Audubon bird walks, or they travel out through all of Northeast Ohio to do the bird walks, or to look at the migrating birds. Flights back, the birds don't leave all at the same time, so you don't have that big grouping of birds coming back. So they do migrate back, but they come back in different stages, and they don't have the same plumage anymore. Their spring plumage is very bright and beautiful to attract the females, mostly the males. So coming back, they don't have those bright plumages. But that's mainly why they're migrating when they come through, yeah.
And maybe it was a different reservation, but doesn't Ohio and Erie Canal, don't they do like a bird where they catch them and record what they're seeing?
Yes.
I don't know what the property
Rocky River, they do it at Rocky River Reservation too, but here they're doing it again. There's two different surveys that do. They do the just a regular bird banding, and they do have, I think there's one coming up soon. We put it in our Emerald Necklace when they're doing it so people can come and observe them doing the bird banding. But they're also doing what's called a MAPS, M-A-P-P-S, but I can't remember what it stands for. They net the birds, capture them, put bands on them, and then release them, and they've started that in 1999 here, and now to 1990 to 2003 they were banding, and now they just started back this year again to see if anything's changed. They had a really great discovery. They recaught a cardinal that they caught 10 years ago. And it was with a juvenile, so they think this cardinal has been around here all this time, because cardinals don't migrate, they stay around all winter. And they believe he has raised young again, because there was a juvenile with this male cardinal. So that was a really exciting find, that the habitat's good for them and he's still around, so.
Right. Cool.
Yeah.
just briefly, if you wouldn't mind just kind of explaining that.
Okay, the bird banders will set up what's called mist nets, and they're just very thin light nets that have very small holes in them. They put them up between poles and make them somewhat taut so that if a bird flies into it, it gets its feet tangled or its wings tangled a little bit in the nets. And the birders, then the people, the volunteers or whoever's doing it, will go out, gently remove the birds from the net. You have to have really good training to do it so that you can untangle the net from the legs and the wings without harming the bird. They look at the bird, study it, identify it, if it's male, female. They can tell if it's a female, they'll be able to tell if it's had young or if it's sitting on young or in a nest, if how much it's eating, the health of the bird, what it looks like. And then they put the little bands on it. The bands have certain number on them that they record it, and I don't know exactly where the records are kept. Probably like either Ohio State University, sometimes Cornell University, but they keep records of, they weigh the bird also. They keep records of these birds. And again, if they're caught, especially if it's a migrating bird, although they usually don't do migrating birds, but if it's a yellow warbler is a bird that does migrate, but it stays here in Ohio near Canal Reservation and it raises its young. If they capture one of those and flies back to South America and somebody maybe is doing bird banding down there and traps the bird, they can tell, you know, when this bird was caught here and how long it's been, and maybe if it's 3 years or just for that 1 year. So it keeps a record of the birds. Again, to see longevity, if they're returning to the same site every year. So mainly that's it. And once they're done banding it and getting all their information that they need, then they release the bird. Mm-hmm. And they're usually upset a little bit for a while, but they come back, especially by our feeders over here.
Would you mind kind of going through some of the wetlands and the canal, you know, the aquatic animals? You mentioned there are frogs and turtles and fish. Mm-hmm. And could you name maybe some species and describe them?
Okay, the frogs, we have a big variety, definitely toads, American toads. We have leopard frogs, pickerel frogs, of course the green frogs and the bullfrogs, mainly. The turtles, the painted turtle is the one of the main turtles we see down there. It's the legs and under the shell part of it is red and yellow, so it looks like somebody painted it, so that's why they call it a painted turtle, while the top of the shell is just the brownish color that most turtles have. We have snapping turtles, huge ones. A lot of the fishermen have their bait taken from them by the snapping turtles. Also, the red-eared sliders are an alien turtle, invasive, although they've sort of adapted pretty well to the area. There's soft-shell turtles that you see sometimes, and the main one is the Blandings turtle that we have here. Blandings is pretty rare turtle for our area. Mainly you see them up in Toledo area. They like more of a marshy type environment, but we've had a Blandings turtle here that in 2002, I think it was, that it came up to our center and laid its eggs in our flower bed. Everybody was so excited about it because, again, it's a rare turtle. Our natural resources came out, built a big fence around the nest because the turtles lay eggs down in the ground, on the soil. So they put a big fence around it to keep the raccoons from getting at it because raccoons like turtle eggs. They love to eat them. The natural resources people would come out all the time, constantly checking, asking us to check it to make sure. So eventually the eggs did hatch. Half of them were sent to the zoo to be raised for 2 years to give them a head start on life, while the other half were released back into the wetlands area. And ever since then, they've been doing surveys on the Blandings turtle that they've put tracking devices on some of them, the ones that are older, and they notch them, their shells, so they can tell which ones they are if they have recapturing them. So they've been doing recapturing surveys, putting nets into the wetlands and baiting the nets, and the turtles would go in there and they would check on them once or twice a day and to see what's come up. And they've been tracking one that has one of the originals that were put in the pond. It's almost to the point where it's old enough to start breeding. So the Blandings turtle is a larger type turtle, and you could tell it by it's a big yellow, bright yellow neck. So if you see a turtle out there bathing or sunbathing and it has this big, bright yellow neck, you know that's the Blandings turtle. So let's see what else. Wetlands. Again, different types of fish, carp, bluegill. We do stock the canal for fishing, so there's trout and catfish in there also.
And when you stock the canal, do those fish start breeding naturally in the canal? Or?
They don't, because most of the fishermen know they're stocked and they're down there every day to fish. As far as the trout, they probably don't, because they can't take the heat. But they did put bass in there, and they think that the bass have reproduced. Catfish definitely will reproduce, and the bluegills, but they're more common. And of course, the carp. They're always a lot of carp. Some of the other animals that you might see down there with the beaver. The beaver has moved in and established home down in the area. So all along the canal, you'll see some of their evidence of them, of the trees being cut down. Chewed down and knocked down, and they build, the beaver build bank lodges. They don't build a typical beaver house that you see in a big lake. So their wood branches would be alongside the bank of the canal or bank of the river. So we have a lot of beaver. We have muskrat. You see the muskrat houses down in the ponds. They're made of plant material, so cattails. So that's how you could tell the difference between beaver and muskrat. Muskrat houses are made of plant material. Coyote, we don't see them often. We hear them a lot, especially at night. If you're in the park at night, you'll hear them howling. Like again, wild turkey. We were just told we saw some young turkeys with the adults, the male, females. Deer. We have, like I said, we have a lot of deer. They did a survey on the deer where they tried to do some birth control, captured the deer and gave them birth control medicine or shot. It didn't work, but you still see some of the deer. This was a good 10 years ago at least. Some of the deer, they'll still have collars around their neck from that survey. Not too many yet left, but they've survived. But the using the birth control method did not work. So
I just saw another way.
Yeah.
Kind of talking about shifting gears to plants.
Okay.
Are there any plants or wildflowers that you think visitors will kind of really be able to pick out if you describe them for them?
Well, right now, right now the wingstem will be blooming. There are tall plants all along the canal, especially down where the fishing area is. They're probably about 6 feet tall. The plants grow 6 feet tall. They have yellow flowers, on the daisy-like flowers on the ends of the plant. They call it wing stem because if you look on the stem of the plant, there's green growth growing on it. It looks like part of the leaf has come out and it's growing along the end of the stalk or the end of the branch. Stalk of the plant. So it looks like little wings coming off of the end of the stalk, and actually it's just a growth of the plant material coming off. So that's why they call it wing stem. So that would be one. It's very noticeable because it's so tall. Ironweed is probably be starting soon. It's a really beautiful dark purple flower with maroon stem. Joe Pye weed is blooming. It's similar looking to ironweed, but it's a really pinkish lavender color. So right now, those would be the plants now in fall or late summer that would be blooming. In the spring, we don't have too many spring wildflowers in this park. We have one little patch of Virginia bluebells, actually a large patch of May apples. which look like little umbrellas. They grow maybe about a foot tall. The leaf looks like a little umbrella. And underneath is a pretty one little flower with white petals. Eventually, as it matures, it turns into a, looks like an apple. So it comes out in May, and it looks like the fruit looks like an apple, and so that's why it gets its name, May apple. A lot of raspberries, a lot of multiflora rose, which is a, an alien type species, but when it blooms, it's really pretty, the white flowers. But again, it's an invasive.
And with the kind of the wetlands, can you describe those a little bit in regards to plants? And where is actually the wetlands located?
The wetlands, it's most of it's located down below the visitor center. So you have to go down this steep hill, and you get to the first leveled off area. It's called Blue Heron Boardwalk, but it's a wetlands. Mainly it's just a permanent source of water, small pond. That's where you'll see the muskrat house. Cattails grow in it. They have a lot of pickerel weed blooming, purple flower in the water. We have some water lilies blooming in there. So again, it's just a small pond area that's it's good for the birds, you know, the wildlife. Green heron you see out there a lot.
So, is that a natural ecosystem, the wetland area?
I think it's been enhanced. It probably was a wet area at one time, and Cleveland Metro Parks enhanced it a little bit, maybe dug it out a little bit more, did some planting of water plants in there.
Another question, it's a pond there, right on the map? Right, that little guy? It's hard to see the trails over it.
Trying to get my, these ponds are not the same.
Oh.
Okay. The wetland area would be right there, like where number four is.
Oh, okay. Does it say wetland in there?
I cannot read it. What does number four say?
Blue Heron Board.
Yes, that's it.
Okay.
Yes. The ponds that you were talking about are the ones that are north of here, along the mountain bike trail. Those ponds were created and used by the steel industry. The American Steel and Wire was there. One of their buildings are still down here. What's called a pump house is still down along the canal. They would use the water from the canal to cool the steel and wire that they were creating, the steel that they were creating. They used the water to cool it, then they would pump that water back into these big ponds that you're talking about along the Mount Bay Trail. So they're still there. You know, American Steel Wire is not, it's now Charter Steel. They do not use the pump house for anything. But if it wasn't for them using that, the source from the canal water to cool their stuff, would not have, the canal would not probably not have water in it anymore. I mean, it that extended the life of the canal for a different use in the industry. You know, before it was just to transport goods on the canal boats, and then after that ended, the steel industry was still using the water from the canal for their use. So it kept the water and the life of the canal still running up until, you know, 1950s or so.
We'll go ahead and take this last number five question. question.
Okay.
How active is the Metro Parks in maintaining, you know, the habitats, and what kind of the different approaches of that are? And then we'll move on to the Washington Reservation.
Okay. Cleveland Metro Parks is very, has a very active role in maintaining the park. I mean, that's one of our conservation, education, and recreation is our motto. It's not the word I wanted to use, but so definitely conservation of natural environments. They're always maintaining the area. Right now, Natural Resources Department is in looking into trying to eliminate a lot of the invasive species. Ohio and Erie Canal Reservation is the one reservation that has the majority, most of our plants in the area are invasives. A lot of Japanese knotweed and, like I said, the multiflora rose, the honeysuckle. So they've been trying to cut back on that, trying to eradicate some of the invasives to allow the natural plant population to come back.
Kelsey, do you have any more questions about Ohio Erie Canal before we move on to Washington?
Okay.
All right, so then we'll flip back.
Okay.
To Washington Reservation. And actually, I think the question is starting on the same page.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're just going to start off with what I've never actually heard of Washington Reservation. So can you explain kind of what's there and, you know, kind of main attractions there?
Okay. Washington Reservation is our 15th reservation. It was dedicated in 2003. The main feature of the reservation, though, is the Washington Golf Learning Center. So 50 of the 70 acres is the golf course. Washington Reservation starts where Ohio Near Canal Reservation ends, which is at Harvard and East 49th Street. So if you cross over Harvard into and go on to East 49th, it becomes Washington Boulevard. So it starts there, and it used to be part of either Newburgh or Cuyahoga Heights Park system. So there's just a small stretch on the east side of the Washington Park Boulevard that is Washington Reservation. It has small picnic tables, a ball diamond, just an area for the general public to walk along. There's a trail, all-purpose paved trail that runs along it. Further down, it gets into again, part of Washington Park opens up into, again, the golf center, and which is the horticultural center, Washington Park Horticultural Center, which belongs to the city of Cleveland, Cleveland Municipal Metropolitan School District. There they have, the kids come from high school. It used to be South High School, but it isn't anymore. But they come there to learn skills in agricultural, agribusiness, that they call it, which is small engine repair, like lawnmowers and such, small animal care. They have a greenhouse there that the students learn how to, you know, plant stuff and learn how to sell for, like, if you decide to go into a nursery business. There's also the Arboretum is there, and they set the Arboretum up, I think it was 1970, And it's just, it made the whole area, the buildings, made it more of a park area for the buildings that were there. And along with that, the students could use the Arboretum as a study, as a little outdoor laboratory to teach them about park settings and how to manage a park. There's the USS Maine Memorial, which is, it was put up there after the Spanish-American War, which was in the 1890s. The US Maine was blown up and it was supposedly was the start of the Spanish-American War. Why that, there's just a center post of one of its stacks, the ship's stacks, just part of it that's sitting as a memorial. Don't know why it was brought here to Newburgh Heights. At the time, throughout the whole country, people were taking pieces of this ship that, and making memorials out of them, but we don't know why one was brought here to Newburgh Heights. There's a small trail along the golf course. The Washington Golf Learning Center is the biggest feature of Washington Park. It opened in 2007. It was a partnership between Cleveland Metro Parks, First Tee of Cleveland, which is an international organization, City of Cleveland and the school, City of Cleveland Schools. First Tee Golf is, the golf course is a 9-hole par 29 golfs course with a driving range. First Tee of Cleveland teaches life skills to golfing students, the younger children, trying to teach life skills to them through the game of golf, you know, to learn patience and respect for your other players and fair play, that type of thing. So they're using golf as a tool to shape the children's lives and give them maybe a better focus on where they want to go in their life. The golf course is like in the heart of the city, nature in the heart of the city. The golf course is a gold certified Audubon sanctuary, signature sanctuary. The golf course has to be, it's to allow for nature, the wildlife, conservation of wildlife. So the golf course was created according to standards of Audubon to receive this gold certification. Have to have habitat enhancement, resource management has to be done a certain way, energy efficiency and water conservation, make sure there's habitat for the wildlife. Cleveland, our reservation, Cleveland Metro Parks employees here at our center do bird surveys there. We try to do them once a year, once a week at least, especially during migrating time, to identify the birds that are there. Audubon is a birding organization. Their main focus is bird and the habitats of the, protecting the habitats of birds. So in order to keep our certification up, we have to follow certain guidelines, and one of them is to do the bird surveys, report them back to Audubon at the end of the year. Again, we get a lot of migrating birds there. The Baltimore Oriole and the Orchard Oriole both are known to nest there and raise young. The mockingbirds are there all the time again. Brown Thrasher I've seen with young there. So the golf people see wild turkeys, coyotes, I've seen coyotes there. So it is a great habitat for a golf course, and it's a small golf course, and right in the heart of the city, you would never know that there'd be so much wildlife there. What else?
I was going to ask a little bit more about the arboretum, is that
what you're talking about?
Arboretum.
Uh-huh.
Kind of, what is that, and where is it at the reservation there?
Okay, arboretum is actually, most arboretums you go to is trees, all different types of trees that have been planted or natively grown there. Most of the time, they're marked as to what kind of trees they are. A lot of arboretums will have non-native trees growing there. You'll see a lot of trees that have been brought over maybe from Europe or China or somewhere like that and planted. Mainly, I think it's just to study them, see how they grow, what to do to take care of if they get infested with some type of disease, how what to do with them, maybe experiment, see what type of spray or what type of what you can do to save the tree. But mainly it's just to study what types of trees are there. You know, get a closer look at the tree, examine it, look at the leaves and learn what the tree is like, what it looks like, so you can identify it in other environments.
And you said that was naturally grown?
Some of them are. Some of the trees are naturally grown that are there, but I did notice others that are not, that have been planted. A lot of arboretums do plant non-native trees in their arboretums.
And is that just to kind of see how they do and what they bring to the habitat? Or
I'm not sure why people create arboretums. I think mainly to study the plants. I don't know what the focus is on arboretums, why people plant them, but I know they're all, I've seen them all over, and South Chagrin Reservation has one. South Chagrins, though, are more native. Most of those, they'll have a patch of oak trees, but all different types of oak trees. And again, it could be to be able to identify them. This is a red oak, this is a pin oak. So a student or anybody could go there, look at this tree, and start identifying the differences between them. It's an oak tree, but why is it a pin oak? Why is it a red oak? Look at the leaves. So I believe that's part of it. And then again, like they said, it's just makes it like a nice park setting for the campus, for the buildings that are there. Another reason, just it's a nice setting.
And is there any benefit to the natural habitat of having an arboretum?
For the most part, I think. It depends on how much of it is native plants and how much of it is not native. There's a lot of oak, different type of oak at Washington Reservation. I know that, and probably maple. For the habitat, definitely for the birds and the squirrels and the other animals that live in the area. It provides shade, it provides food, it provides shelter.
What other kinds of trees are there?
I don't know. Yeah. I can just picture the one, but I don't know what it is. It gets this beautiful, in the spring, it gets this beautiful, long, yellow flowers on it. It looks similar to a lilac, but it hangs instead. But that's the only one I really recognize. I don't know what other plants are there. I haven't looked, so.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Okay.
On the question sheet.
Okay.
Do you have any final thoughts about the Erie Reservation or the Washington Reservation or both?
No, right now just the concern of the drought to see what's going to happen with some of the wetlands area because it is drying up a lot. Mm-hmm. How much damage that would do to the environment and to the animals that live there? Will they come back just fine next year when we get more rain and snow? What's exposed now that it's, you know, gone, it's drought and the water has receded somewhat back? What's underneath, what's exposed? Mainly that. Seeing what's going to happen now that they're removing a lot of the invasive species, are they going to replant some other plants to replace them, or how long will it take for these invasive species just to come right back again? The Ohio and Erie Canal Reservation, eventually we're going to be hooking up to Mill Creek Reservation, so we'll be heading out. There'll be other ways to get around. If you're coming down onto our reservation, you may be able to go over to connect to another area besides the national park. They're trying to finish the northern section of the all-purpose trail. Like I said, our reservation ends at Harvard. You have to get onto the road to get to the rest of the trail. You have to get onto Jennings to get to Steel Yard Commons, and then the trail picks up there. Supposedly they're going to be building it all the way down to the lake, so our reservation will be connected all the way to Cleveland. We get a lot of bike riders in now, and a lot of people are just waiting so they can ride down to Cleveland on a trail. What the future is going to be like, and we'll see what how it goes. And again, we'll be doing Audubon bird walks and more bird netting to see how the bird habitat is, if the habitat changes and what birds are coming in, if they've changed any. It's exciting that we're such a small reservation and almost in the heart of the city, surrounded by a lot of industry, and how much wildlife is actually here. Coyotes, turkeys, like I said, all kinds of birds. So that's an exciting part, and it's exciting when people come in and say how beautiful everything is, and never knew you were here, and so that's the fun part of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.